A women's rights group demonstrated outside the headquarters of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals today, protesting the group's, quote, degrading and exploitative treatment of women. PETA has come under increasing criticism for its ongoing ad campaign, featuring nude or semi-nude women in sexually provocative positions promoting veganism or opposing the fur industry.
They make women strip down, put vegetables over their genitals, and subject them to hours of photo shoots. No living creature should be treated like that.
Joining us now is Marcia Astley, director of Women Deserve Better. Ms. Astley, you call PETA's treatment of women cruel and inhumane.
Yes, I do. Each year, hundreds of women are forced by PETA into the most horrifyingly degrading acts you can imagine, holding live animals against their naked bodies or being shackled and put in cages while photographers snap pictures of them. It's horrible.
Well, you're especially critical of PETA's live protests.
Yes,
We're seeing some footage of those here.
Look at these poor women. They're made to stand outside all day in the wind wearing nothing but lettuce leaves or wear a gray bikini and pretend to be a mouse stuck in a glue trap.
Look at that.
Just so PETA can get coverage on the local news.
Now, let me just play devil's advocate here for a minute.
Sure.
Is it really worth it to spend so much time protecting these basically clueless women? They may not even comprehend what's happening to them.
Well, Brandon, once you see the torture a PETA volunteer lives with every day, how can you not help them? You know, some are fed nothing but lentils and not dogs before performing on the Howard Stern show.
Oh, my God.
Coached to talk about how vegans' vaginas taste better than meat eaters.
We're looking at some undercover footage that your group has shot.
Yes, we snuck a camera into a PETA office and saw proof of an upcoming ad campaign that was so sexist and shallow, it's hard to believe it could happen in a civilized nation. But we're not just making a point, we're also taking action.
Well, that's
we're starting
important,
a new program this month to rush PETA protests, recapture abused women, and take them to a farm where they can live out their lives in peace.
Well, good luck with your cause, Miss Astley.
I appreciate that. Thank you for having me.
PETA released this statement in response. We have no intention of changing our tactics until every last animal on the planet is given more respect than women.
Half-inch fears, ready to bite. Never said you're sorry, cause you've always been right. Tell me I'm lame every Saturday night, cause you drink too many and you wanna fight. All my life, hold my breath. Wonder what trouble is coming next. Hold on tight, through this mess. Sing that song, cause you sing it best. La, 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 la.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. I hope you all had an enjoyable holiday break. Mine was incredible. More about that in a minute. I got all the cookbooks that I wanted for Christmas, including Mama Fuku from David Chang. Man, now that is a great book. It's a cookbook, but it's also got some of the greatest insight on opening a restaurant than any book I've read. David Chang is incredibly candid. You've heard me play stuff from him on the show before. He's not afraid to say that he sucked. And he still doesn't really feel all that worthy. Yet he's got this great passion for cooking, and he makes some of the greatest food in all of New York. So sometimes I just don't get it. Maybe it's like a false sense of self-degradation. I don't know. It's such a great book. It's written so well. There's so many great recipes there. And if you're an absolute noodle nut like me, whether it be ramen, pasta, or even the rice noodles, you'll get such an education from the book. I can't suggest it enough if you're influenced by Asian cuisine. And what foodie really can't say they're not? I mean, if it wasn't for China and most of Asia, you know, I wonder how much of the food that we've been enjoying for the last 100 years would even be here. But it was interesting to note that when they opened their ramen shop, they weren't even making their own noodles, and that a lot of ramen shops don't. You know, they'll buy their noodles from someplace that makes them. But then, you know, your ramen shop won't stand out from others. So you basically, eventually, you're going to have to make your own noodles if you want to be, you know, a ramen restaurant that people are going to say that this is the best one. Now, Joe had a post on Marcel from Top Chef Season 2, and it featured his dishes at the Bread Bar's Hatchie series here in Los Angeles. And she wrote something really interesting, and it kind of hit home with me a little bit because I think there's a lesson for everybody to learn here. She said, when I initially met Chef Marcel Vignon, is it Vignon? In the Bazaar's kitchen last year, I thought he was full of arrogance, so much so that the first thing I said to him after a cocktail or two was, I hated you on Top Chef. Then she goes on to say that she felt bad about this later because after getting to know him and realizing what a nice person that he is, that she let the editors of a reality show form her opinion of Marcel instead of meeting him herself and getting to know who he is. She said it made her feel so bad that she later apologized to him, and now they've become really good friends. For as much as I love Top Chef, I think this happens quite a bit. It's unfair how they make some of these people out to be bad guys. I mean, sure, some of them do arrogant things. They say arrogant things, but it's not really that consistent. You don't see what happens when the camera's off. In Marcel's case, I think it was the case of a confident, hotshot young chef just trying to let the other contestants know that he was a force to be reckoned with. And he was. But I think the lesson here is that we can't let our first impressions form our opinions on anything. Not just people, but food, things in general. We've heard that old adage, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover. Sometimes you can't. No matter how confident you might be about something, you've got to give it a chance. I wrote a long piece on Ludo Bites at Royal Tea over the holiday, and it was about how I think a lot of people fail to realize what it is they're actually experiencing when they eat Ludo's food. Some may even fail to take a second bite because their initial impression of Ludo has already formed their opinion, and that's wrong. Now, we were at a food and wine event here in Orange County, benefiting the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, earlier in December, and we met Brian Malarkey, who was a Top Chef Season 3 finalist. Really nice guy. Made some really decent food at this demo that he did at the event. So afterward, during the demo, he was talking about molecular gastronomy, kind of taking the piss on it. Afterward, I asked him about it. I asked him about molecular gastronomy, since he seemed to be so adamantly against it. And he hates it, by the way. He said he's leading the pack on trying to keep out molecular gastronomy from professional kitchens. Anyway, he mentions that it was he was part of this Top Chef Masters show when they got down to the final four or something. If you remember, if you watch Top Chef Masters, they had a bunch of old Top Chef contestants from previous seasons kind of sign on to be like their sous chefs. So each one of the Top Chef Masters had to pick these guys as sous chefs. So he was one of them. But this was past, you know, when Ludo was on. We asked if he knew of Ludo, because he hadn't met him on the show, but he may have seen it. And he goes, oh, yeah, is he that angry, pissed-off French guy? And I looked at him, and I said, Brian, come on, man. You know these shows are edited. He's not like that. He's a very nice person. And he just kind of, you know, he disregarded me like it didn't matter. But that's what I'm talking about. I think you've got to be adventurous. I think being adventurous is really healthy for us. Try new things. Try not to pigeonhole everything you see based on your first impression. Don't poo-poo something simply because you don't think you'll like it. Get out there and try it. Explore new things this year. Maybe that should be your New Year's resolution. Don't let your first impression of something rob you of an experience that you may just love after all. I saw The Cove over the holiday. And I know I talked about Food Inc. quite a bit. I talked about it like crazy last year. And I was hoping that it would win the Oscar for Best Documentary this spring. But The Cove was great, and it too is about food, and I didn't realize that. But really, it's much more than that. It's mostly about the shameful things some Japanese fishermen are doing in this small town of Taiji, and they're feeding dolphin meat to children, disguised as something else. They sell it in markets disguised as other fish. And ultimately, it's about how eating fish has become so dangerous for us that eating it every day, as some people do, can be actually harming your body instead of being healthy for you. It turns out that dolphins eat a lot of fish, so the Japanese fishermen see them as pests, so they round them up and they kill them. If this whole movie follows former dolphin trainer Rick O'Berry as he tries to shake his past and seeks redemption. In the 60s, he was the person who captured and trained the five dolphins who played the title character in the TV show Flipper. I know I've got a lot of 40 and 50-somethings who listen to my show, and I think y'all know who Flipper is, right? You know about Flipper? Flipper was this dolphin. It was a lot like Lassie. I mean, these people, they lived near the ocean. They were always doing stupid shit in their boat, getting in trouble, and Flipper would have to save their ass all the time. It's kind of like Lassie. You remember that crap? Billy's falling into the well, Lassie. Go get help. That type of thing. We're trapped in this cave, Lassie. Get some dynamite. Blow us out of here. Oh, shit, Lassie. Here comes my dad. Quick, eat this baggie of downers and marijuana before he sees me with it. That kind of stuff. Just lame. And I know collies and dolphins are super smart, but if you watch these shows, you would think they were 10 times smarter than the people who owned them. That's how bad it was. You know Lassie, man. She's a dog. She just wants to lay around, sleep, chase some birds, maybe lick her butt every now and again, eat. You know, she can't get a moment's rest because the people who own her keep falling into wells, getting lost, stuff like that. And Flipper was a dolphin, doesn't even have thumbs. He's carrying boxes of explosive back to shore, writing out checks for bail because Greg got popped for possession, some crap like that. Really stupid. But it was a fun show, very successful. And it turns out that Rick had this really close relationship with these dolphins and started to realize that they hated being in captivity. So the show is ending and they're shipping all these dolphins off to these, you know, these places that do dolphin shows and kind of amusement park type of places, which is also really big in Japan. So one day the main dolphin that played Flipper came to him in the water, stared at him. It was really depressed, stared at him. Turned itself upside down and stopped breathing, drowned itself. It committed suicide right in front of him. And he got so depressed that it killed him a little inside. So from that day forward, he started working to free these dolphins in captivity. And this mission brought him to Taiji, which is a town that appears to be devoted to dolphins. And in this remote cove that's surrounded by barbed wire and no trespassing signs, there's a really dark secret. It's here. Under the Cove of Night, that the fishermen of Taiji, driven by a multi-billion dollar dolphin entertainment industry and this underhanded market for mercury-tainted dolphin meat, they're in a really dark place. And the nature of what they do is so bad, and the consequences are so dangerous to everybody in Japan, that they'll go to great lengths to halt anybody from seeing it. So these guys go in and they expose it. And what shocked me is that I found out that mercury levels are at such dangerous levels in all fish, and not just dolphin meat, all fish. And this really expensive sashimi-grade ahi that people are shelling out $60 to $100 a pound for, the mercury levels are even higher in those fish. Higher because they eat a lot of fish. They're predators. The bigger the fish, the higher the mercury. So you're paying twice as much for better-tasting fish that's twice as bad for you. It's just startling. So, The Cove. That's Food Inc.'s Oscar competition. And listen, if that wins, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't even be upset. Both great films about food that made really good points and hopefully continue to make a difference.
But I do want to say that we try to do the story legally.
There it is. A little town with a really big secret.
It's so bizarre. What's going on over here?
When we first got in the country, we had no idea who was following us.
You think they know we're here?
We didn't know if it was the whalers, the Japanese mafia.
Somebody's behind me. I don't know who that is.
They don't like me. They don't like my message.
Rick is world famous for his work with dolphins.
I feel somewhat responsible because it was the Flipper TV series that created this multi-billion dollar industry.
The dolphin smile is nature's greatest deception. It creates the illusion they're always happy.
You realize after a while they don't really belong in captivity.
I'd never seen so many dolphins before.
The Japanese people don't even know about it.
They take the boats around to the secret cove that nobody could see.
They're afraid of cameras. They said if the world finds out what goes on here, we'll be shut down.
They were hiding something.
We need to get in there and film exactly what happens. We need to know the truth.
We needed people with a special set of skills to implement this mission.
They're behind me.
Let's go.
Good luck.
Underwater camera is set.
They're not being told that the free lunch meat that their children are getting are contaminated.
Let it not be said that you didn't know about it. You know about it.
If we can't fix that, there's no hope.
Okay, there's a flashlight. Guards are moving.
Get out of there. Get out of there now.
So the beer I'm having today on the show is Anchor Steam's Our Holiday Beer. It's that from 2009. The first time I ever tasted this beer was in December 2005, and we were recording the first three episodes of Dude Night, at Gonzo's house, and Don had brought this big-ass Magnum of the 2004, and he cracked it open. I'd never tasted it, so I didn't know what to expect, and we were already getting pretty hammered. So I realized after getting a look at the label, it was like 9%, and we were going to feel this one. And when I tasted it, it reminded me a lot of this holiday beer that I tasted in the tasting room at Hale's Ales in North Seattle. But the beer from Anchor Steam had more roasted flavors to it, more of a hop bite. So it was more of a porter than it was this malty strong ale. And the holiday beer from Hale's was a lot sweeter, kind of like a barley wine, and had all these holiday flavors, cinnamon, nutmeg, anise, cloves. It was right then, I think, I realized that craft beer was more of a craft. You know, I think it had more flavor to offer than a lot of people realized. That was when I started to realize that craft and beer kind of made sense together. So, you know, somebody crafted this thing, and I really liked it. And I wish we could have taken some home, but it was one of those pub-only beers. But I find this Anchor Steam a little lacking when it comes to flavor when compared to Hale's, which is the only reason why I brought that up in the first place. I like the more sweet malt flavors, less of the harsh roastiness that this Anchor Steam has. And again, this hop bite is probably the one thing that's kind of curbing it a little bit. But there's lots of ginger, almost like gingerbread because of the biscuity flavors in the beer. It's good. You know, it's called Our Special Ale. That's what they call it. Anchor Steam's Christmas Ale, basically. And they've been making this since the 80s, since the late 80s, I think. And I wonder what aging would do for this beer if it sat for a while. Probably would mellow the hop flavors out. I might just keep one and sell her that. Anyway, decent beer from Anchor. Certainly nothing I could drink all night long, but it's nice to have on the show because it's a new year. And Fritz Maytag, you might know who he is from Maytag Washing Machines. He was like the grandson. He started Anchor Steam. He's one of the first microbreweries here on the West Coast. Really good stuff. So as a Christmas gift, Peter and Joe wanted to take us to dinner. And not just dinner, but dinner at Bouchon in Beverly Hills. Bouchon, as in Thomas Keller. Maybe you heard of him. Just opened not long ago, so weekend reservations were kind of a premium, especially around the holidays. And this place was posh. It's in Beverly Hills, for one thing. So you're like right in the heart of Tinseltown. You valet park your car. The inside of the place is beautiful wood, brand new, just looks fantastic, elegantly decorated, elegantly lit, great furniture in the lobby. Just a super nice place. We walk up to the restaurant. We meet Joe and Peter. There's a little small bar off the side of the restaurant, and we order cocktails and a dozen fresh oysters on the half shell. Freaking incredible oysters. Fresh, salty, perfect oysters. I love eating raw oysters, and these were absolutely maybe the finest I'd tasted, hands down. I'd asked if they were North Point, and I don't remember what she came back with. I don't know. They look like North Points for me, so for the show's sake, let's just say that's what they were. Anyway, they offered these with mayonnaise and cocktail sauce. And both sauces were great, but neither sauce did the oysters any justice. On their own, they were perfection. They tasted clean like the sea, exactly what an oyster should taste like. When you hear stories about how the oyster has its own seasoning, it really does. These were great. It was not fishy. It wasn't nasty. It was perfect. Again, you know, people poo-poo the idea of eating oysters. You got to have an oyster like this to truly appreciate it. Get past this whole it's a texture thing, okay? Get over yourself. Try this. It's fantastic. This is how you start an epic meal. And had I known what was coming, I probably would have passed out. So we get to our seats, right? And Joe and Peter start us with this big cone of pommes frites and a tureen of foie gras that's served with these croutons on like kind of like wedge fries, looking wedge fries, but they were, you know, bread. So we ended up eating the foie gras right on the French fries, which seemed almost stupidly opulent, you know. As it warmed up, it became like a vat of butter that I was dipping my knife in and just eating right off the knife. It was ungodly rich, decadent, one of France's greatest gifts to us. And with each bite of that foie gras, secretly, I was telling Roger Moore to go suck it. I just don't see how anybody could say no to this. Seriously. Peter had a ribeye that was cooked sous vide with cream spinach, potato gratin, and baby heirloom carrots, which are these little, they're baby carrots, right? But these were like orange, white, purple, yellow. And I couldn't believe they're different colors. I go, how'd you do this? He goes, oh, they're heirloom carrots. Katrina brought up a good point. How do you get heirloom carrots? Because once you pull a carrot out of the ground, that's that. You've got to replant seeds. And I'm thinking maybe they pull the seeds from these carrots that they've already pulled from the ground, and they plant the seeds back. Got to check that out. It's interesting, and it's something worth checking out anyway. Joe had the roast chicken with ragu of wild mushrooms and a chicken jus. I had boudin noir, which is blood sausage, with a potato puree and caramelized apples. Now, the potato puree tasted so rich of butter that Peter called it butter puree with a hint of potato. And when I got home that night, I snagged the recipe out of the Bouchon cookbook, and I'm going to share it with you guys shortly. It's killer. It is absolutely killer. Certainly not something you'd eat if you were trying to, you know, keep the LBs down, but my God, that was decadent. Katrina had the croque madame, which is a ham and cheese sandwich that's made with brioche, ham, Gruyere cheese, topped with a fried egg and Mornay sauce. And that was served with a mountain of frites that basically went untouched. It was just too much food. Never before have I eaten at a restaurant of this caliber and felt more at home. This is my food. It's right in my comfort zone. I feel really comfortable saying that. I strive to cook this kind of food at home. I've made it many times. I've made a lot of these dishes many times. Cooking French is what I'm trying to do. It's what I try to do best. It's what I'm trying to really get good at. And I do everything I can to get better and better at every time I cook, breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Doesn't matter. I'm always trying to get better at this. I can't come close to the technique that these chefs employ that work in Keller's Kitchen, but I've got the rest of my life to try it, you know? And eating this food urges me to get better in the kitchen. Because it was one of those times when nothing on the table was inferior. Nothing was on that table that wasn't the best quality in both ingredients, technique, and preparation. So, dinner's winding down. Peter pays a check, very gracious, and we're looking around the room to see if there are any celebrities there. Because we freaking out. You know, we're in Beverly Hills. There might be somebody here. Turns out, two tables away, Don Johnson. He's a little older than you'd think he would be because, well, of course, you know, think about how old he is. He looks great, by the way. And just across the room from us, two tables the other direction, is famed producer Robert Evans, who I later learned was a big deal at Paramount Studios in the 70s. Producer Godfather, Chinatown, The Kid Stays in the Picture. He's a really big deal. So, and Peter and Joe are really into him anyway. So it's nice to see people in Hollywood enjoying themselves at a great place like this, especially, you know, something as famous as Bouchon. Suddenly, as we're looking over at Don Johnson, Katrina says, "Oh, look, Thomas Keller." I'm like, "What?" Here's Chef Keller comes walking right through the dining area to Don Johnson's table to say hello and ask them how they liked their meal. Stayed there for a long time, crouched down, and I'm staring at him like a mental patient. Right, because he's Thomas Keller. I think at one point, I think I called him the President of the United States of Delicious. That's my name for him. So I stared at him for a long time, and I was kind of in awe, you know, that he was there in the presence of the greatest chef I know, the one man that I look up to as much as I had Julia Child. I was amazed to just be in the same room with him, but it got better. The entire time we had been eating dinner, Joe's being really friendly with our server, this guy from Poland. He worked at Bouchon in Las Vegas for a few years and eventually made his way here and was just getting himself settled into L.A. So Joe says, "Have you been here? Have you been here?" And he goes, "Oh, no, I haven't tried it." She gives him her card. She goes, "If you'd like to visit Gelada," which is that Thai place that Joe is really crazy about, and I've yet to visit that. Anyway, she'd like to take him there, keeps saying, you know, send me an email. So he says to her at one point, he goes, "Have you ever heard of Animal?" Now, he's asking Joe if she's ever heard of Animal. Now, you know Joe. She's like best friends with these guys. She says, "Yeah, I know them. I designed their website for them." Anyway, this entire time, after we'd finished our meal, they must have looked her up or asked somebody about her because something clicked. As we're staring at Chef Keller talking to Don Johnson, the manager of Bouchon approaches our table and asks us if we'd like a tour of the kitchen. And I've got really bad manners at this point. I shot up and I said, "Yeah." of course. I found it within myself later to say, "Yes, thank you." But anyway, we're whisked off to the kitchen. I turned around. I looked at Katrina. I go, "Can you believe this? We're about to tour Bouchon's kitchen." Dude, I was in heaven. We were in the kitchen at Bouchon. I'd seen the kitchen of Bouchon Bakery in Napa. But to get a tour of the kitchen at Bouchon made that tour seem trivial. It was sensory overload. It's the most gorgeous kitchen I'd ever seen, busy as hell, packed with cooks, organized, clean, lined up like nothing you'd ever seen. There's a fish station, there's a saucier, there's the grill, the chef de cuisine in the middle. I couldn't take it all in fast enough. Jo starts looking for her camera in her purse, gets her camera out of her purse, asks me to hold her purse, this big turquoise purse. So here I am holding her purse. She starts snapping pictures of the kitchen. Next thing I know, in walks Chef Keller. He looks at us, then he looks at the manager, and I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh, shit, Chef Keller's about to kick us out of his kitchen. But no, he doesn't do that. The manager says something to him I couldn't hear. He reaches out to us and starts shaking our hands, asking us if we had a good time. Shakes every one of our hands. Unbelievable. Right in the middle of service. Here we are. Then Jo, who's fearless, she goes, my friend Phil's a big fan of yours. He's got a podcast, My Life as a Foodie. Maybe you heard of it. Could I take a picture of you two together? And he says, yes. Yes. F me. Right in the middle of service, he's agreeing to let us pose with him. So Jo goes to take a picture of me with him, and Chef Keller sees that I'm holding Joe's huge turquoise purse. He says, hey, Phil, maybe you ought to put down your bag. In that split second, I thought to myself, wait a minute. Not only have I just met the best chef in America, in the world, and shook his hand in his kitchen, but did he, holy shit, Thomas Keller's breaking my balls for holding a huge turquoise purse. I couldn't hand it to Katrina fast enough. I didn't even want to screw the moment up by saying that's not mine. I'm not a metrosexual chef, seriously. No, I just stood there with the biggest shit-eating grin I could muster. Jo snaps my picture with him, and it was epic. My adrenaline level was at an all-time high. The whole thing was surreal. Peter snaps a picture of Jo with Chef Keller. We thanked him for allowing us to be there, thanked him for the meal, and left. And as giddy as we were leaving that beautiful place, it got even more surreal. Because this cute couple, very excited, were hanging out by the kitchen. They were excited to see Keller too. But more importantly, their daughter was working in the back. It turns out, these were the parents of Christina McAmer, who won Hell's Kitchen a couple of years ago. And they came to see her from St. Louis. We saw them later in the lobby. And they told us that she won Hell's Kitchen and then was given the senior chef position instead of the executive chef spot that they promised her. When she worked for Ramsay for just under a year, and then got her sommelier certification, then lands in Beverly Hills to work for Keller. The thing was, they said that there were like something like 1,500 applicants who wanted to work there, and she was chosen as one of them. So it must have been a really hard job to land. But they were so nice and so excited. And Jo tells them, hey, Don Johnson's still in the dining area eating. So she wants to go see Don Johnson now. So Jo takes her back over there. We're talking to her father. Dude, I was laughing my ass off. Never would I have expected this meal to be as exciting as this. And you got to understand something. This is a big deal. I mean, you've been listening to my show. You know how much reverence I have for chefs, especially one of the most highly regarded chefs in the world. To have these things happen unexpectedly with Jo and Peter with us, and because of them, just too much. Katrina and I drove home that night stunned. It's a perfect meal in the perfect place with the perfect friends. The perfect night. It ended in a way I could never have imagined it ending, and I had a hard time getting to sleep that night. So, because I had a hard time getting to sleep, I'm looking up this recipe. Bouchon potato puree, a puree de pomme de terre, maybe. I don't know how you say that in French. 2 pounds of Yukon Gold potatoes, kosher salt, 8 ounces of unsalted butter, chilled, and I mean chilled, keep it in the fridge until you really need to use it. And these the butter's cut into tablespoon-sized chunks. 3/4 cup of heavy cream. The thing here is you place the potatoes in a large saucepan with cold salted water, bring it to a boil, and then reduce the heat and let it simmer for about 20 minutes or until they're completely cooked through. You drain the potatoes in a colander, let them sit for about 2 minutes to dry, and you have to peel them while they're still hot. Place half of them in the ricer or a food mill over a saucepan, mill or rice them into the pan while they're still warm, add half of the chilled butter, take it out of the fridge, add the chilled butter, take the other half of the potatoes that are cooked, peel them, put them in there, add those, you know, mill them, add them, then add the butter. Over low heat, whip the potatoes into a frenzy with the butter in the saucepan in a circular motion with a stiff spoon until smooth, usually about a couple minutes. This mixture is going to be really, really stiff. You can do this ahead. You can kind of let it sit in the saucepan until you're ready to serve it. When you're ready to serve it, Put the saucepan over low heat and add 3/4 of the cup of warm cream, about 1/4 cup at a time, stirring constantly. Make sure that you stir and stir and stir. Don't burn the potatoes at the bottom of the pan. Once all the cream has been added, continue stirring until the potatoes are soft and creamy. You want these things really, really, really creamy. If they're too heavy, you can add a little bit of warm water to lighten the consistency. Then you season it with salt to taste, and that's it. Bouchon potato puree. I swear to you, you'll die and go to heaven.
Do you have your medical marijuana card? That's the first thing we would ask.
That card gets you into Ganja Gourmet, where you can belly up to the bud bar, as in marijuana bud.
What we'd like them to do is come sit at the bar and give us their order. And then if they want to choose a table, they could choose a table, they could sit on the couch, and we'll bring the food to them.
Evan is the pastry chef.
When I had my back surgery back in 2001, was when it was offered up to me, medical marijuana, you know, smoking it wasn't an option, so I figured I'd cook with it.
The menu is extensive.
Lasagna, hummus and pita, pizzas, but we also serve desserts like cheesecakes, brownies, and a New York treat we call almond horns, which are fantastic.
It's also pricey. A brownie is $10, and a dozen lemon meringue tartlettes, $120. Horowitz says he's owned the building for more than a dozen years and used to make those little magnets that real estate agents give out. But that tanked with the real estate market, and he decided to look into opening a medical marijuana dispensary.
What I discovered is that they all ran good businesses, but they were all about getting the patient in, selling them the medicine, and getting them out.
With live music, couches, and the bud bar, Hope's Ganja Gourmet fills a niche.
There were very few places that had a place to chill and meet people, and none of them had an emphasis on food.
Medical marijuana patient Don Armstrong thinks it's a great idea.
I only get out to go to the grocery store or to the VA. So this is an opportunity for me to get out and socialize a little.
Speaking of first impressions, if I told you that I was going to serve you seal meat for dinner, would you eat it? I think most of you would probably say no. Why? Because your first impression would be that it's, you know, this cute little animal and was more than likely clubbed to death. I had elk and seal at a special dinner for New Year's Eve. My friends Maria and Don invited us for dinner, and I was okay with the elk, but I felt a little sense of guilt about getting ready to eat seal. But it was explained to me that there's this ritual with Native Americans in Alaska where they honor the seal in this ceremony before it's killed, and it's killed, you know, with a bow and arrow, and it, you know, adrenaline doesn't rush through the body. Well, it turns out my friend, his brother and his sister-in-law live in Alaska, and she's Native American, and every year there's this whole ceremony where they, you know, they praise this animal and they eat it. And so they sent him some, and I wasn't going to say no. The animal died for a purpose, and, you know, they offered it, and I'm going to eat it. It was interesting. I, you know, like I said, I'm not going to say no. They use all the animal. None of it's wasted. And I don't know what part we ate, but the animal gave its life. And I was curious what it was going to taste like. You know, it's not what you'd think. There's so much blood running through this animal that the meat tasted less like beef or fish like you might think it would. It tasted like kidneys. If you like eating offal, kidneys, liver, this would definitely be something you could eat without a problem. And it wasn't that bad. Getting over the fact that it was a seal, that was the toughest part. But he braised it in a marinara sauce, which was really tasty. And so I think he prepared it the way you probably should. And I'm glad I had the opportunity to taste that meal. So thanks to Donna Maria, if you're listening. It's one of those things I can add to my book of life experiences with food. Had I just rejected it, I would never know what it tastes like. And knowing that the animal was sacrificed for Native Americans, I felt we were kind of honoring the animal a little bit by eating it. So it was a really interesting evening. And the elk was like maybe the best tri-tip you'll ever eat. It was fantastic. Just really good. Good stuff. Now, Katrina sent me an article over the holiday that hit home right here on the show. You recall this huffing and puffing I do about the use of antibiotics in cattle and how these animals are eating so much corn that they have to be given a ton of antibiotics to keep them alive long enough for the slaughterhouse to process them. Cows aren't designed to eat corn. They're supposed to eat grass. And because of the corn diet that they're on, the cows are so sick that when we kill them, if it weren't for the antibiotics, the animal would die before they had a chance. Just put it to you that way. So this AP article says that once curable diseases such as tuberculosis and malaria are now mutating into aggressive strains that resist drugs, And the reason is the misuse of the very drugs that were supposed to save us has built up drug resistance worldwide. More and more Americans, many of them living far from barns and pastures, are at risk from the widespread practice of feeding livestock antibiotics. These animals grow faster, but they can also develop drug-resistant infections that are passed on to people. The issue is now gaining attention because of interest from a new White House administration and a flurry of new research tying antibiotic use in animals to drug resistance in people. Researchers say that the overuse of antibiotics in humans and animals has led to a plague of drug-resistant infections that killed more than 65,000 people in the U.S. last year, more than prostate and breast cancer combined. And in a nation who used about 35 million pounds of antibiotics last year, 70% of the drugs, 28 million pounds, went to pigs, chickens, and cows. Worldwide, 50%. This is a living, breathing problem. It's the big bad wolf, and it's knocking at our door, said Dr. Vance Fowler, an infectious disease specialist at Duke University. It's here. It's arrived. So if you want to know why I keep barking about independent farms and trying to buy grass-fed beef, free-range proteins, this is it. Our food, the food we're relying on to keep us healthy and alive, is making us sick and inevitably will kill us. And if you think I'm full of crap, keep eating McDonald's. It's funny, you know, Bob from The Bob Show, he meets me at a party at Joe's, and he says, you know, you're a lot different in person than you are on your show. On your show, it's like, ah, fuck McDonald's. They can kiss my ass. In real life, you're this really nice and polite, kind person. I said, you know, Bob, go fuck yourself. No, seriously. I said, I'm not acting differently. There aren't any things that I say on this show that I wouldn't say in person every day. I can't stand some things, yeah, but I'm not going to go to a party and start talking about how much Paula Deen sucks unless someone brings it up. You know what I mean? I'm a nice person. I'm kind. I try to stay as thoughtful as possible. It's not shtick what I do here. It's just my voice. You know, this is the place I can do that. I really do want to see radical change in our food, in our policies, in how we approach eating, food in general. That is kind of like my life mission now. And it's not just the show. The show is a big megaphone that I have. It allows me to talk to a couple thousand people every time I decide to go on a rant like this. But ultimately, I want to be nice to people. I want everybody to be nice to each other. The problem is, we're surrounded by assholes and bullies. So, I'm going to take those to task when I can.
Just as recent salmonella concerns led to a recall of more than 20,000 pounds of beef, a new report finds gaping holes in the government system to trace the food supply. Food facilities are required to register with the Food and Drug Administration to enable the FDA to trace food sources and remove contaminated products from the supply chain quickly if need be. But an audit from the Department of Health and Human Services Inspector General finds that of 130 facilities surveyed, nearly half didn't provide accurate information about who to contact in an emergency. And it found more than half the managers at those facilities were unaware of the registry requirements. It's something Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, who chairs a House subcommittee on agriculture, says is unacceptable.
It's shocking, and it really is appalling because this is about safety. This is about public health. When you have negligence like this, then you put the public health at risk. And, you know, this costs lives.
A salmonella outbreak among peanut products earlier this year may have been linked to 9 deaths. In another outbreak, officials believe tomatoes to be the source of illnesses, only to find out weeks later that jalapenos in Mexico were to blame.
Who's guarding the store here? That's what the issue is.
DeLauro blames negligence at the FDA in the prior administration and supports legislation that would give the FDA greater power to enforce rules. And the FDA, in a statement, says the FDA agrees with the findings of this report. We are hopeful that the food safety legislation currently moving through Congress will go a long way toward resolving many of these issues. A program was put in place after 9/11 to protect the food supply from bioterrorism, a threat that seems remote to nutrition expert Marion Nessel, author of Safe Food.
Right now, we don't need to be worried about bioterrorism. We have plenty of our own problems with our own food supply that we can't seem to get a grip on.
As for possible solutions, one recommendation made in the audit is to give the FDA authority to impose fines on facilities that don't comply with regulations. A similar case is made in pending legislation. Mary Snow, CNN New York.
Hey, look, as long as I'm beating the same drum, how's this one? Bubby sends me this article from the New York Times, and it's basically, it reiterates what we already know. But now it's starting to appear in mainstream media, so we don't look like a bunch of wackos. 8 years ago, federal officials were struggling to remove potentially deadly E. coli from hamburgers when an entrepreneurial company from South Dakota came up with a really great idea, injecting beef with ammonia. The company Beef Products Incorporated had been looking to expand in the hamburger business with a product made from beef that include fatty trimmings the industry once relegated to pet food and cooking oil. The trimmings were particularly susceptible to contamination, but a study commissioned by the company showed that the ammonia process would kill E. coli as well as salmonella. Officials at the USDA endorsed the company's ammonia treatment and have said it destroys E. coli to an undetectable level. They decided it was so effective that in 2007, when the department began routine testing of meat used in hamburger sold to the general public, they exempted beef products. With the USDA's stamp of approval, the company's processed beef had become a mainstay in America's hamburgers. McDonald's, Burger King, other fast food giants used it as a component in ground beef, as do grocery chains. The federal school lunch program used an estimated 5.5 million pounds of the processed beef last year alone. But the government and industry records obtained by the New York Times show that in testings for the school lunch program, E. coli and salmonella pathogens have been found dozens of times in beef products, challenging claims by the company and the USDA about the effectiveness of the treatment. Since 2005, E. coli has been found 3 times and salmonella 48 times, including back-to-back incidents in August in which 2 27,000-pound batches were found to be contaminated. The meat was caught before it was eaten. In July, school lunch officials temporarily banned their hamburger makers from using meat from beef products facility in Kansas because of salmonella. The third suspension in 3 years, yet the facility remained approved by the USDA for other customers. Presented by the Times with the school lunch test results, top department officials said they were not aware of what their colleagues in the lunch program had been finding for years. In response, the Agriculture Department said it was revoking beef products' exemption from routine testing and conducting a review of the company's operations and research. The department said it was also reversing its policy for handling beef products during pathogen outbreaks. Since it was seen as pathogen-free, the processed beef was excluded from recalls, even when it was an ingredient in hamburgers found to be contaminated. If this isn't the biggest horn going off in our ears, I don't know how much louder it could get. It's a big wake the F up for anybody who eats fast food burgers from chains like McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, any plain wrapped ground beef you're purchasing in a grocery store. You can call bullshit on me. You can call me a hippie. You can call me a tree hugger, whatever. But every time you bite into that burger, you may as well wash it down with a big swig of ammonia. Because you're poisoning yourself.
Horrific scenes like this of cows too sick to walk going into slaughter led to an unprecedented USDA ban on so-called downer cattle earlier this year. And now the Humane Society of the United States wants that ban extended to pigs. This is the Society's undercover video showing pigs unable to walk, about to be slaughtered, a standard and legal practice.
Well, just because a practice is standard doesn't mean that it isn't inhumane. In fact, there are many standard practices within the world of animal agribusiness that are very cruel and inhumane, and one of them is the slaughter of these downer pigs.
Not only cruel, but the Humane Society says it's also dangerous to our health to have so-called downers like these enter the food supply.
You can't tell just by looking at a pig whether the pig is down because of fatigue, because of injury, or because of sickness. Indeed, the science is very clear that these pigs are at increased risk of having disease. They're more likely to contaminate their hide, and some of that contamination can get into the plant. So there's multiple reasons why animals too sick to even stand up or for whatever reason really should be excluded from the food supply.
But the National Pork Producers Council says robust checks are already in place to prevent contamination.
We have to have USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Food Safety Inspection Service personnel on staff. And as you said, Nicole, the person who looks at those, examines those pigs on the hoof or alive is a veterinarian. And so that veterinarian would look and say, do basically just a quick physical exam. Is the pig healthy? Is it not? In my professional judgment. On the other side, after the pig has been harvested, the veterinarian and FSIS inspectors are also looking at the meat and at the organs to make certain that there's nothing going on.
So you're saying basically that farmers already regulate this on the ground. So why not just codify it? Why not just put this regulation on the books?
We estimate that if all non-ambulatory pigs were banned, all fatigue pigs were banned from the food supply, we would lose approximately 41 million pounds of safe pork going into the food supply. That pork is safe, so not only would it costs producers, it would also cost our friends in the packing industry, but then ultimately consumers, because there would be less pork on the market.
Keeping them honest, we reached out to the USDA and asked why pork just wasn't included in the regulation passed in May. They said the scope of that review was too narrow to include pigs, but they tell me they will continue to evaluate other measures that allow for the humane handling of all livestock. Nicole Lapin, CNN, Atlanta.
On the other side of the coin, I got to mention this. While I was reading David Chang's book, I found out about Poulet Rouge chickens. Supposedly, Poulet Rouge, the finest tasting chicken in the world. And they're not horribly expensive either, considering. I'm going to place a link to this place. You can order these on the website, mylifeisfoodie.com, if you're interested. A little pricey, but not really when you consider what you're getting. The Poulet Rouge is from the same breeding stock used in France for the Label Rouge program, which produces the finest poultry in the world. A Poulet Rouge chicken is a true slow-growing heritage breed bird with, as they put it, parchment-like skin and an unsurpassed flavor and texture. You'd have to fly to Paris to taste a chicken like this. Here are a few key points about these chickens that caught my eye. Slow-growth heritage breed. That means they took their time growing this bird. No antibiotics, no hormones or growth stimulants. They're fed an all-grain diet, no animal byproducts, so no chance of any kind of disease. Grown in a true free-range environment, grown on small family farms practicing sustainable agriculture. A whole chicken, 2.5 to 3 pounds, $15. JoyceFoods.com. I'm going to put a link on the site. If you're interested, you can also just get the breast or get it boneless, if you don't want to go through the trouble of getting a whole chicken. But I like whole chickens. Anyway, Poulet Rouge. Sounds good. Hey, thanks for listening. Welcome to a new year. Man, did it ever get off to a good start for me. I hope you guys have all had a really good beginning. Because 2009, distant memory. We're all going to forget about it. 2010 is the way to go. Music in this episode from Smile Empty Soul. You can download it from the iTunes store for 99 cents. Check our website, mylifeisafoodie.com. There's a direct link. Great band, worth the money. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Happy New Year, kids.
Half-inch fuse, ready to bite. Never said you're sorry, cause you've always been right. Tell me I'm lame every Saturday night, cause you drank too many and you wanna fight. All my life, hold my breath. Wonder what trouble is coming next. Hold on tight, through this mess. Sing that song, cause you sing it best. La, la, la. With the rent, but I never say die. Wet my bed, is it ever gonna dry? Learn to take your shit with a big ass smile. All my life, hold my breath. Struggling off visions of an early death. Hold on tight.